Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. As always, Trent and Leighton Kling with you. We'll talk about various first quarter earnings releases and also about Gap closing a total of 75 stores. Our interview guest this show is Kirsty Smith. She is the Director of Communications for the Joplin Area Chamber of Commerce, and she'll join us to talk about how Joplin's retail scene has rebuilt and grown in the 5 years since their May 2011 tornado that killed over 160 people in the city and leveled a number of businesses in two different commercial districts in the city. But our first story today, we get final word from the bankruptcy auction that Sports Authority will be shutting all their locations down by August 31st as they sell off at a bankruptcy auction, but no bidders were found willing to operate the stores. Dick's and Modell's lost out. Instead, a private equity firm buys what's left of Sports Authority, and they've got to liquidate, Leighton, by August 31st.
Yeah, it looks as though the private equity firms that put in the winning bid didn't want to operate the stores, as you mentioned. The winning bidders were a collective agreement between Tiger Capital Group, Hilco Global, and Gordon Brothers. So all of these firms are going to continue operations and shutting down at the 140 stores that we had reported on. But yes, all 310 stores that remain for Sports Authority will be shut down. And it looks like they'll be liquidating the inventory at the remaining 310 stores on May 25th. And this will be done by August 31st. So this is really kind of a sad time. The debtors and creditors had initially wanted whoever had the winning bid in the liquidation bankruptcy auction to take over and operate the 310 stores. But in the agreement, the winning bidder said they did not want to operate the stores. So this looks like it'll be the end for Sports Authority.
And as it was originally reported, it was confirmed that the entire firm, close to $1.2 billion in total debt. And basically, it seems like what these private equity firms are banking on is their ability to manage the real estate left over from all these store closures and perhaps be able to turn a profit above and beyond what their bid is and the debt assumption.
With this, Trent, you did mention that Dick's and Modell's had put in bids for the remaining assets from Sports Authority, but it looks as though Dick's isn't going to get any of it. And with that, they actually disclosed guidance and renewed guidance for the rest of this fiscal year. They had initially come out with expectations that they were going to be taking over some of the Sports Authority locations and some of their assets, and stated that earnings should be between $2.85 and $3 per diluted share for this fiscal year. But now they've come out and said since they lost that liquidation auction, they are going to actually lower guidance to the $2.60 to $2.90 range. So this is actually looking bad for Dick's in that they're able to not capitalize as much as they thought they would be. Obviously, this is going to help their overall market share within the sporting goods industry, Trent, but overall, they aren't going to be getting any immediate sales from these assets.
At the same time, it at least clarifies a little bit where Dick's standing is in terms of the industry for stockholders. And now stockholders aren't waiting on whether or not Dick's is going to acquire a certain number of Sports Authority stores. And let's be honest, they could still certainly acquire some of that real estate. You mentioned the market share, but also it's entirely possible that the private equity firm could sell off this real estate to Dick's later on down the line, but they just weren't the winning bid in this case. Modell's the other bidder, and I find it interesting that Academy didn't submit a bid at this auction because they were the other company, a privately held firm that was rumored to be in on perhaps purchasing some of these locations and some of these assets from Sports Authority.
Yeah, absolutely. It surprised me that the report said that they were not in the running for the bidding. Perhaps they had already seen this coming and then decided to take a step back and kind of renew their efforts maybe down the line, like you say, when the private equity firms are selling the leases and the land owned by Sports Authority. I did want to mention that Katie Nemec, who is the spokeswoman for the National Sporting Goods Association, did make a statement on this Sports Authority closing, and she was quoted as saying that it's a hyper-competitive industry and that a lot of these retailers are having to compete with online retailers who don't have to tack on sales tax onto merchandise, and therefore some of these brick and mortars are facing an unfair advantage that is increasingly more difficult to overcome.
Sales tax certainly plays into it. So too does selection. Obviously, with your brick and mortar store, your selection is going to be limited in comparison to what you could offer as an online presence. But overall, we've still seen some growth in this industry. Dick's has shown some growth, and Academy as well, even though they're a private company, as we mentioned, so we don't have public financial numbers. They are at least growing in terms of locations, and that's before we include a lot of the outdoors outfitters like Cabela's, Bass Pro, those type of companies. But I know East Bay is one of the big online firms, Amazon as well, and there are probably 100 other online firms that sell sporting goods. So as they mentioned, this is a competitive space. We talked about issues with Sports Authority earlier on the podcast. About 3-4 weeks ago, we talked about what's been dogging Sports Authority over the last few years in terms of pricing, in terms of product mix, and all of that kind of coming to roost here in 2016. And you mentioned like they couldn't manage to even sell their name at the bankruptcy auction or the right to have a company's name on the Broncos Stadium, which right now is Sports Authority Field, used to be Invesco Field out in Denver. So that kind of tells you how weak perception of the brand is. Even at a lot of companies that go bankrupt, companies like Service Merchandise, for example, or we had Children's Palace and Child World profiled on a previous show, most of those companies will sell their name or be able to sell their name in bankruptcy. That's not the case here, and that kind of tells you where the brand of Sports Authority is resting.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think it's more of the brand image and what they've been able to cultivate over the last 10 or so years in terms of a negative public perception. So that's a really good point you make. And I also want to touch on, along with that, the fact that between 2010 and 2015, sports equipment sales have grown to the online space to the tune of 15% of total sales, and this is compared to the 2010% of 11.8. So if you're looking at growth, this isn't a huge growth industry when you're thinking about sporting goods sales going to the online space. It is obviously growing and taking some market share, but it's nothing that's exponential in nature. And so along with this, we see that athletic and sports footwear increased to 17.2% of overall sales, this up from 12.8% in 2010. So really, to blame sales tax and those kinds of things, and then the emerging ways of omnichannel and those kinds of things, those are legitimate worries for the sporting goods industry. But overall, you're not seeing the e-commerce space take too much of a chunk from the sporting goods arena as it stands now.
Well, let's move on to our second set of stories. A number of companies releasing first quarter earnings. We talked briefly on the last podcast about Home Depot and Lowe's releasing earnings. You mentioned you were looking ahead to the Walmart earnings call, and you also said that you felt like earnings were going to be better than expected for Walmart and better than analyst expectations, and that's exactly what we got from the retail giant.
Yeah, Walmart was initially projecting lower than expected sales for this quarter, but they came out for the first quarter guidance and earnings per share hit 98 cents. This also excluded a $3.5 billion currency impact. We know that there's a strong dollar in play there. So total, they've increased revenue by almost 1% to $115.9 billion. So actually both earnings per share at Walmart and Walmart domestic comparison sales, so their same store sales, increased. So this is really good news for Walmart going forward. I'm curious to see if they're able to make the good marks going forward with the rest of the quarters. They've also had continued positive growth trends in traffic. Their traffic count for the U.S. locations increased 1.5%. So not only are they increasing revenue, they're also being able to bring customers back into their stores with their continued progress on lower pricing and the site-to-store implementation that they've tried to streamline over the past few quarters.
I'm really anxious to see where their Walmart Pay program goes with the ability to pay from your cell phone to Walmart-specific devices. Another store that reported solid earnings for the first quarter of this fiscal year was Ross. We spoke last week about TJ Maxx and their great first quarter earnings releases. Well, Ross released positive first quarter earnings, positive same-store sales increases. Now, granted, their ratings, some analysts actually slashed them because they didn't have same-store sales growth that was too large. But at the same time, you're looking at comps from a 2015 fiscal year where Ross just blew everyone away. So going to be very difficult to compare 2016 that much favorably to 2015, considering that was a record year for the company. Still, same-store sales grew by 2% in the first quarter of this fiscal year.
Yes, and then also along with that, you see that net income actually came in line with analyst expectations. They hit the mark of 73 cents with earnings per share, and then also they came in at the lower side of revenue expectations, but still within guidance. This is really good for the company, and this is a niche that you and I had talked about. They try to promote apparel by saying that they're 20 to 60% less than the specialty outlets and the name brand clothing retailers. Overall, the company's revenue was up 5.1% compared to the same quarter last year. During the same quarter in the previous year, they did post earnings per share of $1.33, so their earnings per share this quarter are down slightly. But overall, I think the company is doing quite well. They have 1,210 Ross locations in 33 states, including the District of Columbia, and 152 dd's discount stores in 15 states. They are not announcing any closings or anything like that, and they are actually expecting some slight growth for fiscal 2016.
And they're one of the stores we hear so much every week about omnichannel. We hear about e-commerce, and Ross is really one of those brands that doesn't have a strong e-commerce presence because their whole image is tied into getting people into the brick and mortar stores. You mentioned their store count. Their store count has steadily increased over the past few years. They are eyeing continual growth in terms of placing stores in new and different markets. They have a fairly large brand presence in suburbs of major metropolitan areas. You mentioned their store spread really from the Southwest all the way up to the Washington, D.C. area, but they have no place on their website, much is in the similar vein to companies like TJ Maxx, where you can actually purchase things on the website. Instead, you have basically just links to the types of accessories that Ross carries and then a link to a store locator, and that's pretty much it. So out of all the companies that we talk about seeing this growth, we're seeing growth in TJ Maxx and Ross, companies that don't really foray into omnichannel and don't quite do as much e-commerce-wise as some of your larger retailers like Walmart, like Target, and even some of your clothing retailers like Macy's. And Macy's, one of those companies that has taken a few hits in part because of the popularity of companies like TJ Maxx and Ross.
Absolutely. And I think it's positive to note that they've also reduced overall expenses. A lot more of the selling expenses have gone down in the recent quarters. I did want to mention, too, that over the last three previous quarters, they've actually exceeded analyst expectations for earnings. This is really positive. And so their stock is down a little bit. It's trading down 8% for the trailing 52-week period. But really, there's a lot of good things to note here. The only thing that I'm really seeing that's kind of a hit towards their earnings call was a 55% increase in distribution expenses. They opened a couple more distribution centers. And then overall, I think that they're really trying to hone in their own pack-away inventory system. It's a system they've worked out with suppliers in order to gauge when popular items are at their cheapest and try to pack inventory into their distribution centers. And so this kind of hurts gross margins. Gross margins are down 30% from last year, but they're still not at a bad 15.4%. As long as they keep store traffic up and, as you say, kind of drive traffic not to their e-commerce, but from e-commerce to the brick and mortar, I think they should be doing okay for the remainder of the year.
And that pack-away inventory system is something that honestly is necessary for a store like this in order to keep prices down. As essentially, it allows vendors to capitalize on good deals. They store, as you mentioned, the merchandise in warehouses. They built a new distribution center, which was a main factor in the 55% increase in distribution expenses. So a lot of that is one-time expense tied in there. But in order to get that inventory system right, I think the more stores you have, the more stores you build on, the more you can capitalize on that economy of scale and be sure to get merchandise out to a variety of locations. One thing that Ross does do a pretty good job of is send a lot of the branded merchandise, especially in terms of sports teams or collegiate sports teams, to areas that might have a rooting interest in those teams. So they've been able to regionalize fashion a little bit. You don't want to hold inventory for too long, even in a space where you're operating essentially an off-price retailer. But a lot of positive signs out of Ross, and it wouldn't be surprising to me to see any growth in terms of their stock and continued positive earnings. One of the things that you noted before we got to air is that Ross's stock is trading at about 21 times earnings. TJ Maxx, which is kind of everyone's retail darling in the off-price category, they're trading at 22 times earnings. So very similar numbers to Ross. However, the market cap is significantly lower for Ross, $21 billion market capitalization for Ross versus $50 billion for TJ Maxx.
Ross definitely surprised me in that I got to be honest, I wasn't aware that their market cap was less than half of TJ Maxx's. But when you see the stock trailing as it is this week with this earnings news, I would like to see them get more in line with what TJ Maxx has been rewarded with their positive earnings statement last week. I would imagine with a couple more positive comps in the quarters to come that we see that stock go back up and increase in price. Keeping along with earnings, American Eagle has posted positive 4% same-store sales for their fiscal first quarter. They also have a new chief marketing officer from Kate Spade. They just announced this last week. They reported that they are going to have a slow decline in overall growth, but they've had a strong, resounding effort in terms of their brand and their overall market image.
And we talk so much about the teen retailers struggling and suffering. American Eagle, one of those, it's bouncing back from a couple of years really worth of poor quarters and poor same-store sales. Comparable sales, especially of the company's Aerie brand, jumped 32% quarter over quarter. So first quarter over last fiscal year, first quarter, which is really remarkable considering that the expectation was about 14.9%. So more than doubling analyst expectations for an increase in that particular brand area. American Eagle with positive comps across the board. This turnaround began in 2014, where they kind of righted the ship a little bit. We've talked about other companies struggling and kind of running uphill to find the fashion that can carry the day in the teen retailing space. And it seems like American Eagle is hit at least on a small gold mine. Now, sales might not be improving, perhaps, as much as you might have seen them improve back in the 90s and early 2000s. But at least in this category, they are bucking the trend. And that's a positive sign going forward. And also, it helps to kind of bring up the overall downtrodden mall space.
I would have to agree with you on that. Something that really was a bright spot for me on this call was Michael Rempel's, the chief operating officer's, notes as far as branding concerns. They said that they have a strong brand and an exclusive, compelling merchandise category that others aren't really able to match. The other things he was really implying were that they know their target audience, they know their demographic inside and outside, and they are not at all concerned about the e-commerce side of things. When you think of big companies like Amazon coming in, they seemed confident in their brand. They were basically saying that, you know what, Amazon can't sell what we sell. Our customers know what we deliver, and we're going to continue to deliver it and really bring home that brand loyalty. And that's something that I think resonates with a lot of millennials. They want to know what they're getting and that it's on a consistent basis. And so with that, they also have a really good omnichannel platform that they've been building out over the past few years. Their Instagram page has a lot of followers. It has a lot of really good style matchups for all the seasons. They really keep on top of it with their social marketing. Those are two things that I think are going to carry it forward. And I think a lot of stock analysts are really excited about this year in terms of continuing on with this growth. And along with the new CMO, Kylie Andrew, who will start on June 6th. Again, she is from Kate Spade, and she has a long tenured history of good leadership within the marketing department. And she served actually as a senior vice president for Kate Spade through 2015. To be honest, she has a lot of experience. And with this role, she's going to bring even more of a social marketing presence in with the company. So I see good things for American Eagle. As we talk about retailers really struggling in the mall space, American Eagle is not one of them.
Yeah, their earnings, 22 cents per share, net income that is. Analysts had expected 18 cents per share for this first quarter. Second quarter, the company projects 20 to 21 cents per share. Analysts project 20 cents per share. So positive numbers coming from second quarter evaluations. Company's net revenue rose 7.1%, which is a massive amount. As we mentioned at the beginning of the story, it's now right around $750 million. One of the things that American Eagle did to kind of help spur the turnaround, in addition to merchandising mix, was they decided to cut down on promotions. And at the time, people were divided into two different camps. There was the first camp that said essentially that the promotions were a major driving tool behind putting people in the stores and getting people to the website, and that cutting down on promotions would reduce the amount of foot traffic. The other camp said American Eagle customers are very brand aware, and they are very tied into that American Eagle brand. So if you cut down on promotions, essentially those people that are very tied in with the brand, they'll spend money at American Eagle anyway. So your existing customers are just going to be spending a little bit more because you're cutting down on promotions to get the customers that you've already generated to spend money there. They've also done a little bit better job with inventory management, but it appears a lot of these gains have to do with a new method of merchandising things, which is cutting down on their overall promotions, even if it does cost them a little bit in terms of foot traffic, which there's been no evidence to support to this point. It has paid off on the other end because their per customer sale appears to have gone up.
Yeah, while we don't have any exact metrics on foot traffic for these stores, we do know from previous reports and other outlets that mall traffic overall is down year over year, and it keeps going down. It keeps trending in a negative way. But when you look at a 32% increase in same store sales, you got to be really thinking about how the customers that are going into the malls, they're basically just deciding that they're only going to go to a few locations, and American Eagle Outfitters is probably going to be one of them on the list, it looks like, because of those strong numbers. As you had mentioned, they had some higher than usual distribution costs, but their selling, general, and administrative expenses increased as well, 6% year over year to $196 million. And this is, as you had kind of mentioned and reflected on, a higher investments in advertising, variable selling expense, and strategic initiatives that they've put forward. So I'm actually curious if their acquisition of marketing specialist Kylie Andrew will actually increase that number or decrease it in the years to come. But overall, the percentage of sales through ad expense actually went down. So when you're looking at their total amount of revenue, ad expense actually went down in respect to the overall amount of sales. In April of 2016, American Eagle operated 1,046 stores and 145 international licensed outlets across 22 countries. Something I notice here is they want to actually expand that international presence, those licensed stores, to 174 by the end of fiscal 2016. Something that we've really talked on. A lot of companies like The Gap that we're going to talk about a little bit later are actually reducing their international presence, whereas American Eagle sees opportunity to grow there.
You know, you mentioned the reduced cost in terms of advertising and in terms of marketing. Well, a lot of that has to do with the fact that you're rolling back so many promotions. So you're not spending money to promote the promotions that you're no longer having. And so you can cut back on costs that way as well. Well, you mentioned The Gap. Let's go ahead and talk about them now. They're going to close a total of 75 stores, they announced over this last week. And they have lowered expectations for first quarter earnings, something that we thought they might do. You're seeing adjusted fiscal first quarter earnings likely to be around 32 cents, at least that's their forecast. Analysts expect about 32 cents a share. The only difference between analyst expectations and their posting is simply in terms of the overall revenue, where Gap has expectations of $3.44 billion and analysts have expectations about $70 million over that at $3.51 billion. So store closings and also misses on analysts' expectations by a significant amount. We've talked about Gap in the past. All three brands really struggling with the Gap, not only Gap, Banana Republic, as well as Old Navy. Part of that has to do with decreased mall traffic. But again, they're having trouble keeping up with the Joneses in terms of product mix as well.
Yeah, and I think that product mix is, you're really seeing how they are struggling with that when you're looking at the net income. And I draw the line between product mix and net income. The only reason being is they're not obviously able to have those fashionable items that they can mark up and that customers are really wanting. The items that they've been carrying, especially they were hoping for a strong spring season, it really hasn't come through for them. So you're seeing discounted items, which really affects the bottom line and the net income. And speaking of net income, when you're looking at the second quarter of 2015, you're seeing that net income as a percentage of overall revenue was actually twice as much as it is now. So they're really struggling to keep in that net income. And it's not looking good for overall revenue either. As you had mentioned, $3.44 billion in revenue. They're just slowly going down and down with that number. And then also when you're looking at these closings, this represents just a fraction of these 3,700 stores. So you really have to be thinking something that you and I have talked about on previous podcasts is closing international outlets, and in this case, 75, is this really going to help the Gap really focus on operations here domestically and really improve other things such as product mix? I don't think that $275 million in cost savings when you're producing almost $11 billion in revenue annually is really something that's going to make you hone down on what needs to be done for the future of the company. I think this is something that's maybe inherent to the company, something they need to bring in more people to maybe adjust their strategic outlook.
They mentioned, too, that they plan on keeping some of the high-performing locations that they have in Japan, so not all overseas locations are going to be reduced or eliminated. In fact, they still have 200 Gap and Banana Republic stores that will remain in Japan. And the global same-store sales decline, mirroring that of the domestic same-store sales decline, overall, you're looking at a comparable store sale decline of 5% during the last quarter. It's 6% globally, so outside the U.S. When you look back at previous releases by Gap, you've mentioned the fact that they chalked up a poor fourth quarter of the last fiscal year to weather. Well, at this point, it's becoming much more of a trend than just a sporadic small sample size aberration. We're seeing that steady decline that you spoke of. And you're seeing trends really kind of push away from Gap, from Banana Republic, from Old Navy. And if the 75 store removal helps them to focus, that's all well and good. But I'm not really sure I believe or buy into the idea that eliminating 75 stores globally when you have 3,600 is going to completely change the paradigm when we've seen consistent decreases in terms of same-store sales declines, and you're looking at 5, 6% per quarter on a regular basis, and now they're running almost two full years of this type of same-store sales decline.
When you're looking at the closings that represent cost savings of less than 2% of overall annualized company revenue, you are really going to see not much change, I think, in terms of overall company operations. They are going to maybe have to announce something else in the future quarters to come, or maybe pre-earnings calls to really get investors psyched up again and see that this company is going in a rejuvenated direction and going to have to do more than just closing, like you said, a smaller percentage of international stores.
I mean, analysts reduced expectations on Ross because their 29% of overall sales made up by women's apparel wasn't enough for them, and Ross didn't necessarily address it in the earnings call. So I can only picture how analysts are going to treat Gap moving forward, because they're still talking in fairly generalized terms without laying forth a specific plan.
We reported last week that L Brands has been doing well overall in respect to same-store sales and overall comps, but they have actually started to slow a little bit in terms of growth prospects. We had also reported the departure of Sharon Turney back in February, the longtime CEO of the Victoria's Secret division within L Brands. Jan Singer was recently hired as chief executive of Victoria's Secret, a former intimate apparel maker, Spanx, and she is a former Nike executive that comes with 11 years of experience in Nike, 5 years in footwear, and then the last 6 years in general apparel sales. Trent, do you see this as a good sign of things to come for Victoria's Secret, seeing as that they are actually eliminating their footwear division and that Miss Singer has quite the experience within footwear?
You know, I think I look at her experience in other places. You look at the explosive growth of Spanx, the brand. I think she's got what it takes, obviously. And sometimes also, too, we kind of raise an eyebrow to certain things. We noted that, for example, Finish Line had hired a former Nordstrom executive, and that didn't seem to fit, but it's worked out very well for Finish Line. So this is kind of a wait-and-see approach in terms of the evaluation. I do think that it's interesting that L Brands is spending so much time on rehabbing Victoria's Secret, because one of the other segments of L Brands, Bath & Body Works, has had considerable success and continues to grow. And it seems as though there's a little bit of a de-emphasis on that. Victoria's Secret is still going to own the vast amount of market share in terms of lingerie and some of the other products that they sell, because they have cornered the market, especially in terms of brick and mortar. If you're not going to buy that thing at an ordinary discount store or a department store such as Macy's, Victoria's Secret, really one of the only places in a mall setting or even in a strip mall setting that you can find where you can go and try on the products and interact with the products there, which can be important when you're talking about this particular space. I just think it's very interesting that they are cutting down some of the areas that they are. We had talked about them eliminating their catalog division and moving to try and streamline their marketing operations. But one of the other things that they're doing is trying to cut back on the amount of merchandise, not only shoes, but other types of merchandise, and they're transitioning some items to online only.
Yeah, when you're seeing the announcement that they're going to be cutting swimwear, you're really seeing the opportunity for American Eagle and other retailers that we've already mentioned to really capitalize on that. I was really surprised that they reported that they are cutting swimwear, as it accounted for almost $525 million in annualized revenue last year. So management said that roughly two-thirds of merchandise cuts can be attributed to the swimwear category, and the rest are from the shoe category that we already mentioned and the smaller apparel categories that they aren't really in the niche of making. But to be honest with you, I think that this CEO transition is really going to be good for them. I think that she's going to know, coming from Spanx and seeing massive growth in the 1.5 years that she was the CEO over at Spanx, tells you that and tells the market that they are going to be focusing on their lingerie segment. And as you said, they take a very large market share, that over 50% they own of the lingerie market share. So when you're looking at a store that has such a mall presence, such as Victoria's Secret, you really are seeing a store that carries large footprints within this space. If you're eliminating the swimwear and other apparel and footwear, I got to think, where are they going to grow in the future? They are obviously still trying to capitalize on the lingerie market share, but they really have quite the store footprint there, and they need to be able to tell investors how they're going to grow in the future, if not through these other categories. I think surely swimwear would have been a good, almost coming in at $500 million in sales annually, I think that would have been a good place to start, but apparently not. So I'm curious to where Jan Singer's experience is going to come in play here, as again, she has a lot of experience in the footwear industry. Perhaps she's looking maybe in the future to bring some of that back to the Victoria's Secret locations.
And with Victoria's Secret, as you mentioned, the price per square foot is fairly high, so she'll have at least a little bit of room to play with because a lot of their stores are spacious, but at the same time, she'll be facing a lot of pressure to get the most she possibly can out of the square footage that's in the stores, maximizing the brick-and-mortar retail experience while also filtering in effort to the e-commerce division. I think the idea to cut out swimwear is kind of questionable to me, but I think when Victoria's Secret looks at it, they know essentially the margins on those swimwear products. And even though they were producing revenue for the company, maybe their margins on those particular products weren't where they would like. Moving on to our final news story before going to our interview, Nordstrom is beginning to invest a ton of capital into Omnichannel. They're expanding their loyalty program as well. There had been reports of Nordstrom perhaps trimming their IT staff, but in this case, it looks like they are streamlining things throughout their Omnichannel program. And Nordstrom, who is one of the retailers that the market had kind of hit badly and the analysts had been cynical of, seems to have things pointed in the right direction in terms of e-commerce and their Omnichannel efforts.
Yeah, Trent, it seems as though we've actually discussed Omnichannel every week now with another outlet, another retail outlet implementing some sort of way that they can interact with customers, either it be a new web application, discounts with in-store credit cards, and then other online discounts with their e-commerce website. So this comes as they've already spent $3 billion over the last 5 years. That's a lot of capital. And what they're trying to do here is really trying to have the same brand experience translate over into the web application and website. Initially, they weren't having all the exclusive deals brought in from the points that customers would earn by spending at their physical locations. They weren't rewarding those customers in the same way that they would be if they bought something online, even if it were the same or similar item. So now with this, they're hoping to really gain brand loyalty and really kind of do the opposite of what we've seen other retailers do. A lot of retailers, such as actually Dick's Sporting Goods and Academy Sports that we had talked about earlier, even though they're in completely different retail genres, have implemented coupons where they're good for in-store purchases only. And so when you're really seeing this dynamic play out, some retailers are trying to push customers away from the internet side of things, trying to get customers to browse their store and hopefully boost sales, get customers to buy something that they weren't ordinarily going to when they see something and have maybe more impulse buys through that way. But this right here is basically showing that Nordstrom isn't scared to have people shop online and reward them for doing so. They think there's a best of both worlds. They can have the really good shopping experience at Nordstrom, that leading customer service that they bring to the table, and then also carry that same kind of service through their internet offerings by offering the same discounts. When you purchase one particular item, you will get points for that just the same as you would with a brick and mortar store now.
They say that they're implementing this omnichannel push, especially in terms of their loyalty program, as a result of customer feedback, which if that's the case, that's certainly positive and a sign of a company listening to their consumers. Nothing would be more frustrating as a consumer than to have loyalty points either not working for certain avenues or certain places to purchase items, or the loyalty points earned in one location don't cross over to the second one. So the fact that they are streamlining everything for the consumer can only be good for Nordstrom's, and I believe it will build that brand loyalty that those loyalty programs are designed to cultivate. So that's a positive thing. At the same time, that is a lot of spending for Nordstrom in terms of their IT initiatives and in terms of their omnichannel initiatives. So it's a big bet for them to make that they can continue to drive sales in e-commerce and drive sales through their online and in-store loyalty programs. If it doesn't pay off, it could mean bad things down the road with so much in expenditures happening in such a slim amount of time over the last 3 years.
Yeah, you make a really good point there. The massive amount of spending isn't really drawing down to the bottom line just as of yet. They have been growing top line sales. They grew them by 50%, which is nearly $5 billion. But again, overall capital expenditures in this omnichannel space were close to $3 billion over the past 5 years. So when you're looking at it from the logical perspective, like, what is the rate of return on that? It's not really that good. And it's hard to kind of tell what portion of the $5 billion in increased sales came from those omnichannel expenditures. But when you're looking at the overall long-term position, as you mentioned, this is an investment for the future. This is the way things are going to be going in the future. Less people are going to malls, less people are going to mall anchors. And we all know Nordstrom's is one of them. Cutting the staff, as you had mentioned, after a six-month review, the company had announced 2.5 weeks ago they're actually cutting many IT jobs. They didn't specify which ones, but they did specify that they are going to be reorganizing some of the IT departments. They're going to be going through and promoting some people and then laying some others off. They did not give specific figures, but this really shows that what they've already built in as far as an infrastructure for IT over the past 5 years with that massive spending, they're actually starting to see some economies of scale from it. As you had mentioned on the intro for this, they had actually really have been working to streamline all these processes. So overall, spending this year should be around $300 million for IT. And this matches last year's spending of $300 million, but represents a 35% increase over the 2014 budget. In 2017, I'm curious if with these layoffs and the reorganizing of some of these IT sectors, if they're going to be able to reduce spending from that top line of $300 million.
And that is something that you see with a company investing so much in IT. You'll see an initial frontline investment that's very high, and then you'll see some backing off of staff as things become ideally more efficient. And in fact, if things didn't become more efficient, you would have eyebrows raised as to the overall purpose of implementing new technological systems there. So not really a huge surprise that they would be trimming down IT jobs. But as you mentioned, we have no idea exactly which jobs will be cut for the company. Coming up on the Retail Focus podcast, we'll talk to the Director of Communications for the Joplin Area Chamber of Commerce, Kirsty Smith, as she discusses how retail has grown over the last 5 years and how retail has helped to rebuild the city following the May 2011 tornado. Five years ago this week, on May 22nd, in fact, a tornado that reached EF5 at some points blew through the town of Joplin, Missouri, and the surrounding area. The damage it caused from a human level was certainly astonishing. 161 fatalities reported from the tornado, but also a number of businesses and retailers were impacted as the tornado went through the two largest retail districts in the town, both on Rangeline Road there in Joplin and on Joplin's Main Street. But the recovery has been robust for the town, and here with us to talk about the retail recovery of Joplin in the 5 years since that May 22nd, 2011 tornado is Kirsty Smith. She is the Communications Director for the Joplin Chamber of Commerce. Kirsty, thank you for joining us today. And first, to kind of begin with, can you give our listeners a sense of what Joplin is as an area?
Well, Joplin is a regional hub community located in the southwest corner of Missouri. We are a community of about 50,000, 51,000 people by night, but by day the area swells to about 250,000 people. Because of our central location in our region, we are the hub for retail, medical, entertainment, just about everything you need to do, you're going to come into Joplin for from our outlying communities.
Basically, Joplin is, as you mentioned, a metro hub bringing in over 200,000 people during the day. And I'm sure that number swells even on the weekend, which is when the tornado hit back on that Sunday.
Absolutely. It was a Sunday evening. Lots of folks were here shopping, maybe enjoying dinner out. It was also high school graduation day, so that brought even more people to town. And it was the beginning of spring. the weather was kind of nice. And so, of course, people tend to get out a little bit more when the weather seems nice.
So we backtrack to May 22nd, 2011. And, of course, a lot of people probably throughout the country have seen footage of the damage done by the tornado. They've heard about the human toll, 161 lives lost. From a business perspective, from a retail perspective, what were some of the impacts that that disaster had on the city?
Well, our community lost 531 businesses that day. That's all types of businesses, retail, medical, dental, schools, churches, all sorts of businesses. But 531 is a huge chunk of our business community. In addition to 7,000 people losing their homes, we had 500 businesses that had lost their business home. And what you found was some business owners lost their business and their home. Utter devastation, and it really could have crippled this community. It really could have made this community sort of say, we're done. Could have made some businesses pack up and say, nope, we're not going to do this anymore. But it didn't. It didn't do that at all. The best of the human spirit came out, and it came out immediately following the storm. You had people immediately here to help us, working side by side with our business owners, with our residents, to clean up, to get the streets open, to get the word out that we did lose a third of our community, but we had two-thirds left. And that was an important message from the Chamber of Commerce. We wanted to be sure that the public understood, yes, we have businesses that were destroyed, but we also have businesses that are still open and here doing business for you. We have businesses that are doing extraordinary things. We had competitors opening up their offices saying, I know you lost your business in the storm. I have some extra space in my office. You come office with me for a while. It was really an incredible time, incredible time.
Well, that is amazing. And as you mentioned, a lot of the immediate response to the storm overall was also human and family-based, of course, with, as you mentioned, all of the homes devastated in the area. But what was, as you look at the last 5 years, what was the timeline like for the retail recovery in the city as buildings began to be rebuilt and some of those big box stores began to move back in?
Right. Well, it was an amazingly fast recovery for our business community. The big box stores obviously had the resources to start, in most cases, faster than our smaller retail establishments. For example, a home improvement chain that's here in town, they have a disaster protocol in place, and they were able to set up a temporary store in a tent, which was vitally important to our community because they sold supplies that our businesses needed to clean up, you know, shovels and rakes and storage containers and things like that. Those big box stores went very quickly, and within 90 days of the storm, we had some pretty significant openings of the larger retail establishments. But we didn't see anything less from our small retailers either. They worked hard. They cleaned up their own debris. They set up temporary facilities. One facility in particular was a retail pharmacy. And he had been looking prior to the storm to lease a new location and expand his business a little bit. Since he already had that in place, he was able to simply move to his leased location and open up for business within 3 or 4 days. His drug suppliers were able to get him stocked, and that was critical for our community. We lost several pharmacies, and so him being open for business within 3 or 4 days was huge. The very, very first business that rebuilt from the ground up in the original spot where they were located opened on July 2nd. Tornado was May 22nd. So on July 2nd, it was a retail salon, hair and nail salon. And they worked very hard and rolled up their sleeves and got themselves open. And every single business that reopened was celebrated throughout the community. As the Chamber of Commerce, we celebrated those businesses, whether they were members of the Chamber or not, with ribbon cuttings, and we promoted them. We also, as they were rebuilding, we also kept a ongoing list on our website of business locations. We lost a huge portion of our medical community, and people who come into this area would call us and say, I know my doctor, his office was destroyed in the tornado, and I can't get a hold of him. Do you know where he is? And we kept that list, and we could say, yes, he is officing in this temporary location. This retail store that you want to go to is located in this temporary location. We kept that list going for about 2 years after the tornado.
Our guest today is the communications director for the Joplin Area Chamber of Commerce, Kirstie Smith. And looking at the city, the way I understand it, the tornado cut across two distinct retail districts. You had the Main Street retail district, is kind of part of the downtown area, and then also the Rangeline retail district, which hosts a lot of those big box stores and that type of thing. Was development or redevelopment greater in one area over another, or did both of those areas of town kind of see development or redevelopment at the same time?
You know, both areas are seeing redevelopment. The Main Street area that was destroyed was a little bit quieter area. So the city took some measures to really try and encourage some growth in the Main Street area as we were cleaning up after the tornado. And they rezoned part of a connecting street to allow for more commercial. It's 20th Street. And 20th, the tornado basically went straight up east on 20th Street. And so they zoned that street purposely commercial. It was a mix of residential and commercial pre-tornado. So they changed it to mostly commercial to really try and draw the business communities together, the retail communities together between Rangeline and Main Street. So what you're seeing on Main Street now is what you would expect. The more niche retailers with the specific audiences that they cater to. There's a very nice bakery there. There are some retail clothing stores down there, a little bit more boutique setting. Rangeline, as you mentioned, is a little bit more of the large box stores. What you'd expect to see with fast food restaurants and things like that. Very hard hit area, Rangeline was, but all of those large retailers have come back, and we've added several new retailers along the Rangeline corridor, as well as restaurants.
You mentioned the redistricting or redrawing kind of the districts and zoning along 20th Street. What were some of the other things that the city or the chamber did to assist in the retail recovery over the last 5 years?
Well, the Chamber of Commerce was instrumental in helping our business community rebuild. We very quickly identified that we wanted the Business Recovery Center to be located here at the Chamber office. The Small Business Recovery Center is put together by the Small Business Administration, and it's generally located wherever the FEMA headquarters are located in a community. And we said to the FEMA and SBA officials that we really would like those resources to be available at our Chamber of Commerce, because that is the hub for business. So by housing the recovery center in our facility, we were able to bring in some additional resources to help our businesses. We brought in entrepreneurial center from our university to help some of the small businesses with their business plans. We brought in the Secretary of State's office to help business owners recreate their documents that they were lost in the storm. We had attorneys and CPAs there to help offer advice and guidance to our businesses. We really tried to make it a one-stop shop for our business community, because remember, some of these business owners had lost their homes or lost loved ones. So anything we could do to help them get their business back on their feet was crucial. The other thing that we did immediately was establish a business recovery fund. In a disaster, individuals generally receive FEMA assistance to help them get their home back started and rebuild, things like that. there is no source in place for businesses. There's no FEMA for businesses. The only option businesses have are their personal, their business insurance, and loans. So some of the smallest business owners, some of the small retailers weren't able to take out loans or weren't interested in taking out loans. So we set up the Business Recovery Fund. And that the fund was set up with money that was donated to the business community from people all over the country who knew that the businesses would need this assistance from us. The Business Recovery Fund was available to businesses. They were loans, but we had the control over the loan amount, the length of time of the loan, the interest rate. And so they were smaller loans, low interest rate with a long payback period. Those business recovery loans really helped some of our small businesses get that initial capital that they needed to make sure that they had their inventory up to speed or to open in a new location or finish a building that they were rebuilding. And those business recovery loans were crucial to our smallest businesses.
Well, now that we've talked about some of the things that the city and the chamber kind of did to help spur business and retail redevelopment, we can look at it the other way around, too. What impact did the retail recovery and the recovery of those retail districts have on the city and the people that lived in Joplin?
You know, it was a very emotional connection when our businesses started to reopen. We lost the major retailers, of course, but we also lost those local favorites. One favorite, for example, was a locally owned pizza restaurant. And I believe, in all seriousness, we had more calls about that pizza restaurant reopening than some of our other businesses. So the community here was hurting terribly, and they needed their pizza joint reopened. They wanted to be able to go back to their favorite fast food restaurant. And so what you saw was an amazing show of support of these businesses as they reopened and got back on their feet. The idea of shop local didn't even need to be said. Everybody was very concerned with making sure that our businesses that reopened in this community knew that we appreciated their efforts. We were happy to have them back. We were so thrilled with every announcement. XYZ Company will stay in Joplin. We will rebuild. We are not leaving. Those were moments to celebrate. And in the early days, after the tornado, when we were still grieving for our losses, just to know that your favorite pizza joint or your salon was going to reopen, that really helped with your morale.
Well, now, as we've talked about kind of the process of recovery 5 years ago, 4 years ago, and the development of retail, what's the current state of retail in Joplin? How does it compare to pre-2011 levels? And also, what does the future hold for retail in the city and also in the overall metro area?
Well, I'm happy to say that today, 5 years after the tornado, 90% of the destroyed businesses have reopened. 485 out of 531 businesses have reopened. And more than 300 brand new businesses have opened in our community. That is across all sectors, but retail is a huge sector here in our area because of our location. The retail community is strong. We are adding new retail. The city has actually even directed the chamber as the lead economic development organization for the community to pursue more retail, additional retail, to bring them in. And the latest census figures show that our population is actually up higher than pre-2011 numbers. So the nighttime population is growing, and of course we're at no lack for daytime population. So attracting those retailers to our area will continue to happen and hopefully get a little bit easier as we grow larger and larger. We've made the zoning process as simple as possible. We've made the licensing process as simple as possible. There are some building codes in place specifically because of the tornado, but those are in place for folks' safety, and those have been met with great support from our business community.
Kiersey Smith, Communications Director with the Joplin Area Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Really rather remarkable growth in Joplin. They've set a goal. They want 500 post-tornado businesses to open up. They have 300 of those 500 businesses have already set up in Joplin, and they're looking to complete the expansion over the next couple of years. If you'd like more information about the retail recovery after the 2011 Joplin tornado, you can visit the Chamber of Commerce website. That's www.joplincc.com. They've got great information, including a fact sheet detailing retail recovery after the tornado came through on May 22nd of 2011.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We'd like to thank Kiersey for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast. Certainly an enlightening conversation about what's gone on in Joplin, Missouri since that event 5 years ago. Well, as always, we'd like to wrap up the show by telling you about a few things that we'll be looking forward to in the next week, month, or year ahead. Leighton, we'll start with you.
Yeah, Trent, you know, we've talked about IT and then omnichannel. Well, it looks like rent-to-own retailer Rent-A-Center has named a new chief information officer. It's going to be developing talent over all platforms in IT and then hopefully developing new programs and technology for leadership and logistics. Angela Yoakum, Senior VP of IT and CIO, will be her formal company title. She comes to Rent-A-Center with more than 10 years of senior leadership experience. She was actually the CIO of BDP International, which was a global transportation and logistics solutions center. So when you really think about Rent-A-Center here, a lot of the business they do is focused around logistics. They have Rent-A-Center trucks that go and deliver furniture items and then also pick them back up. So that might play a part into this. Usually when you and I talk and discuss omnichannel, we are discussing things such as discounts, web application development, and things of that nature. But with this acquisition of Angela Yoakum, you're actually looking at a different business model that's going to be able to utilize her talents in a different way. So I'm really curious of what she's going to bring to the table, seeing as they really didn't have an emphasis, and that is Rent-A-Center didn't really have an emphasis on this kind of leadership experience previously.
Well, I'm looking ahead towards this next week, and over the next weekend time, we'll have earnings reports from a couple of downtrodden retailers and then one retailer that was at one point really increasing on the market but has since come under hard times. First two retailers, Sears Holdings and Best Buy. Really what we're looking at Sears Holdings is how quickly the decline is taking place. The expectation this year is for a year-over-year loss in terms of earnings per share of $15.07, so it's loss per share on a year. The right now estimated loss for the first quarter is $3.20, so it'll be interesting to see if it comes in above or below that. Either way, though, we're still not likely to see a beat to the extent that it would be a gain per share. Meanwhile, Best Buy, which is been struggling a little bit off and on really over the last 5 to 10 years. Their earnings perhaps expected to decline a little bit. Now we're still talking about earnings per share, looking at about 75 cents on average. Revenue is actually expected to shrink overall as well, so we'll see if they beat those projected numbers. And finally, in terms of Costco, been a very dependable stock, but shares off a little bit over the last 3 months, and we'll see where Costco goes in relation to their market standing, where they've fallen just a little bit over the past few months, or really since December of 2015 in terms of the market. So all of that, we've seen some positive news lately in terms of stocks. Even though Ross was declined by a few analysts, they still posted some good numbers. In the first quarter, we saw Walmart's first quarter earnings beat, and we've seen solid earnings from other companies like American Eagle. So we'll see if that momentum continues into next week with the likes of Sears Holdings, Best Buy, or Costco, or whether those companies kind of continue their declining trend. For my money, I would say Best Buy, Sears Holdings, probably going to be around analyst estimates. I wouldn't be surprised if Costco posts an earnings beat, though.
I honestly will be curious to actually see the Best Buy earnings call. I know that Best Buy Mobile has been doing quite well and has actually been driving those earnings for Best Buy, as the larger locations for Best Buy have struggled to meet expectations over the past few years with the increased pricing pressure that online gives them. Also with that, the second one I would be looking forward to is the Costco earnings call. I would expect them to maybe meet or exceed analyst expectations, but overall, I'm curious to see what they have to say in terms of growth prospects. You see, Costco is a really consistent bearer of good news for its shareholders, but in terms of growth prospects for the future, where are they going to go as they've entered in more of the larger metro locations and they really don't have anywhere to go except internationally at this point?
And their earnings growth is expected to be 4% perhaps for the last quarter. As you mentioned with Best Buy, those Best Buy Mobile locations, the kiosk, are smaller size locations in comparison to their larger footprints. And I know that's something that you're rather bullish on as far as Best Buy as a company.
Absolutely. There's something that's trending for the future. We talk about decreased mall traffic. People are still actually going to Best Buy Mobile locations. That's where they drive a lot of their revenue. Cell phone sales, tablet sales, those are all still very strong.
All right. Well, for Leighton, I'm Trent. So long until next week on the Retail Focus Podcast. Have a great 7 days. And be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcast delivery service, including those like Podcast Republic and Podcast Addict.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.